Hello, everyone, and welcome to M&A Today. My name is Warren Rose, and I am a senior partner at Gross, Rose & Moore, LLC. I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes, not only today, but every Friday at noon Eastern. Man, time is really flying by. This is our 11th broadcast, and our listener base keeps growing every week. So once again, we appreciate everyone who has listened live, downloaded previous broadcasts, and sent us questions. It's really great having you be a part of the program, so keep sending me your ideas, comments, and questions, and if I don't get to them live on the air, I will send you the answers via email. The purpose of this broadcast is to not only educate and inform those of you within the industry, but to give an insight into the advantages of using a professional M&A firm for businesses within the middle market segmentation. Today's episode is titled Angel Investors versus Venture Capital. We will look at the definition, differences, and pros and cons of each. No matter what life stage your company is in or financial necessities you may have, it pays to have a professional M&A firm help you navigate the process and avoid the missteps so many encounter if they're trying to go it alone. We are going to answer a couple of questions from emails that we also received this week. Well, getting into the details of the differences between angel investors and venture capitalists, here's a wide-angle view of the first, from 30,000 feet, shall we say. Angel investors are wealthy individuals or groups of wealthy individuals who invest their own money into companies, whereas venture capitalists, otherwise known as VCs, are employees of venture capital firms that invest other people's money, which they hold in a fund, into companies. Now let's take a closer look at the two before diving into the specific differences. Let's start with what are angel investors. Angel investors are typically high net worth individuals who invest very early stages and formations of startup companies, usually in exchange for convertible debt or equity. The role of angel investors serves as a critical bridge between the startup financing needs of a company and their larger capital needs later on. Angel investors invest their own money, so it can come from a variety of sources. Maybe they sold their own startup, maybe they made a lot of money in another industry, maybe it's family money. There's no one where that we can point to as a primary source of funding for angel investors. In order to be an angel investor, a person does not have to be an accredited investor. However, an important distinction here, there are a lot of angel investors that are accredited investors. In order to be an accredited investor, according to the Securities Exchange Commission, a person must, two things here. First, have made at least $200,000 a year or $300,000 for a couple for the past 2 years and must have the expectation of making that amount again, or have a net worth of over $1 million either alone or together with a spouse, excluding the value of the person's primary residence. Getting into the pros and cons of working with angel investors. We'll start with the pros. One big advantage of working with angel investors is the fact that they are often more willing to take a bigger risk than traditional financing institutes like banks. Additionally, while the angel investor is taking a bigger risk than a bank might, the founder is taking a smaller risk, as angel investments typically don't have to be paid back if the startup fails. As angel investors are typically experienced business people with many years of success already behind them, they bring a lot of knowledge to a startup that can boost the speed of growth. Many startup founders are learning everything from scratch, So having that kind of knowledge on the team is a huge advantage. Now to the cons of working with angel investors. The primary disadvantage of working with angel investors is that founders give up some control of their company when they take on this type of private investment. Angel investors are purchasing a stake in the startup and will expect a certain amount of involvement and say as the company moves forward. The exact details of how much, say, an angel investor gets in exchange for their investment should be outlined in the term sheet. And this is something that is totally negotiable. Now, to what is venture capital? Venture capital is financing that's invested in startups and small businesses that are usually high risk, but also have the potential for exponential growth. As you can tell, this is some sort of the same direction as with angel investors. It's just a different group, it's a collaboration, and they're using somebody else's money. The pros of venture capital starts with the fact that the venture capital is a great option for startups that are looking to scale big and quickly. Because the investments are fairly large, your startup has to be prepared to take that money and grow. The biggest advantage of working with venture capital firms is that if your startup goes under, as unfortunately most do, you're not on the hook for the money because, unlike a loan, there's no obligation to pay it back. That's the same as with angel investors. Venture capitalists come to the table with a lot of business and institutional knowledge. They are also well connected with other businesses that could help you and your startups, professionals that you might need to take on as employees, and, obviously, other investors. Now to the cons of working with venture capitalist firms. While you don't technically have to pay back venture capital, venture capitalist firms are expecting a return on their investment, bottom line. That means that a startup that accepts VC money needs to be planning for an exit of some kind, usually an acquisition or an IPO. If that's not your goal, or if you see yourself running your startup forever, then venture capital is not for you. On that note, part of what venture capitalists want in return for their investment is equity in a startup. That means you have to give up part of your ownership when you bring on a venture capitalist. Depending on the deal, a VC may even end up with a majority share, more than 50% ownership of a startup. If that happens, you essentially lose management control of your company. Let's talk a little bit about the differences between venture capitalists and angel investors. Favored industries, venture capital. Venture capitalists also tend to migrate towards certain industries or trends that are more likely to yield a big return. That's why it's common to see so much venture capital and angel investment activity around technology companies. They have the potential to be a huge win. VCs know that for every 20 investments they make, only one will likely make a huge win. A win for a VC is either one of two outcomes: the company they invested in goes public, or it is sold for a large amount. VCs need big returns because the other 19 investments they make may be a total loss. The problem, of course, is that VCs have no idea which of the 20 investments will be a home run. So they have to bet on companies that all have the potential to be the next Google. Conversely, other types of industries may yield great businesses, but not giant returns. A landscaping business, for example, may be wildly successful and profitable, but it's not likely to generate the massive return on investment that a VC needs to make its fund work. The other reasons VCs tend to invest in a few industries is because that is where their domain expertise is the strongest. It would be difficult for anyone to make a multi-million dollar decision on a restaurant if all they have ever known were microchips. When it comes to big dollar investing, VCs tend to go with what they know. Now let's look at the favored industries for angel investors. They too, angel investors tend to invest in companies and industries that they know a lot about. For example, if an angel investor made a lot of money in real estate, you can imagine that they would be most comfortable putting money back into that industry. After all, they know the industry, including the right questions to ask, what kind of opportunities exist, and who's BSing them. That's not to say that that is the only criteria for angel investors. They may have made their money in gold mining, but they're looking to make investments in tech companies because they think that's where the big upside opportunity is. While you wouldn't want to count out an angel investor who didn't come from your industry, you would definitely want to seek out those who might have a built-in affinity to your industry first. Now we're going to kind of dissect the processes for angel investors and venture capitalists. We'll start with angel investors. Angel investors usually come on early in the life cycle of a startup. One of the reasons they're called angels is the fact that they're willing to put money into pre-valuation startups, which may have a hard time finding funding sources elsewhere. So how do you value a company that doesn't have any metrics yet? One way is to really emphasize the team rather than the numbers or the metrics. Angel investors are particularly interested in investing in the founder with less of a focus on current profit or sales, which are either often non-existent or in the early startups and don't amount to much yet. However, that doesn't mean angels are only interested in the founder. They're also looking at more quantifiable terms, like the size of the market your startup is in, the product itself, how competitive the environment is in, and yes, whether the startup has any marketing or sales. As a founder, it is your job to convince the angel investor that you are the person to run this company and that this company is going to be a serious player in the field. Angels are often one of the most accessible forms of early stage capital for an entrepreneur, and as such, are a critical part of the equity fundraising ecosystem. There is no definitive limit on what a single angel investor can invest, but typically the range would be as little as $5,000 to as much as $5 million, although most angels tend to cap out at around $500,000. Angels may also invest incrementally, offering founders a small investment now with some opportunity to follow on at a later date with additional investment, typically when something important happens within the business, if you've hit certain milestones, for instance. Getting a good angel investment deal structures is all about creating a win-win situation. Once a founder gets an angel investor interested in their deal and agree on basic terms, they will need to discuss the best way to structure the investment. Now let's take a look at the process for venture capitalists. The goal of the venture capital investment is a very high return for the venture capital firm, usually in the form of an acquisition of the startup or an IPO. A venture capital firm is usually run by a handful of partners who have raised a large sum of money from a group of limited partners to invest on their behalf. Those limited partners are typically large institutions like a state teacher's retirement system or a university who are using the services of the venture capitalist to help generate big returns on their money. The partners have a window, It's usually 7 to 10 years in which to make their investments, and more importantly, then generate a big return. Creating a big return in such a short span of time means that VCs must invest in deals that have a giant outcome. These big outcomes not only provide great returns to the fund, but they also help cover the losses of the high number of failures that high-risk investing attracts. Well, we've come to the part of the program here where I get to tell you a little bit about us, Grosch Rose & Moore LLC. We believe it's our client approach that sets us apart from our competition. First and foremost, we listen, and then we take the knowledge leveraged by our experience and vast contacts to create the right fit. We then focus on what is important to you, your business, and any shareholders. We also strive to conduct ourselves in a manner that makes certain everyone is treated fairly and equitably. Really, regardless of who you contract with and what they do, you need an M&A advisory firm that not only has the knowledge and experience to get things done, but understands and cares about your business goals. Kind of back to the listening process again. So, if you are looking to buy, sell, consolidate, form a strategic alliance, or get a business valuation or consultation, call me, 303-941-7865, or email me at wrose@grossrosemoore.com. Bottom line, we only want to see if we've earned it. Even on the buy or sell side, no deal, no fee. It's that simple. Now getting back to some of the questions that were asked last week that we didn't get time for, and even a couple that came in earlier this week. First from Michael. He has an interesting question and asks, how do you account for transaction costs, financing fees, and miscellaneous expenses in a merger model? Well, I can say it this way because I've been around for a while, but in the old days, you used to capitalize the expenses and then amortize them. With the new accounting rules, you're supposed to expense transaction and miscellaneous fees up front, but capitalize the financing fees and amortize them over the life of the debt. Expense transaction fees come out of the retained earnings when you adjust the balance sheet, while the capitalized financing fees appear as a new asset on the balance sheet and are amortized each year according to the tenor of the debt. I ran through that fairly quickly, and to be honest with you, it needs to be done in a certain way and format. So please go in and listen to this broadcast again if you're interested in that. Write it down and make sure that you're following those steps, because it's certainly changed from the way that it used to be even 10 years ago. Next, we have an email question from Frank. Frank asks, what is the difference between goodwill and other intangible assets? And the second part of my question, what other intangibles are there that could also impact the combined company? Those are really good questions, Frank. Thanks for sending them in. The answer is that goodwill typically stays the same over many years and is not amortized. It changes only if there's goodwill impairment or another acquisition. Other intangible assets, by contrast, are amortized over several years and affect the income statement by hitting the pre-tax income line. There's also a difference in terms of what each one represents, but bankers rarely go into that level of details. Accountants and valuation specialists worry about assigning each one to specific items. Now to the second part of Frank's question. You could have a purchased in-process R&D write-off and a deferred revenue write-off. The first refers to any research and development projects that were purchased in the acquisition, but which have not been completed yet. The logic is that unfinished R&D projects require significant resources to complete, and as such, the expense must be recognized as part of the acquisition. The second refers to cases where the seller has collected cash for a service, but not yet recorded it as revenue, and the buyer must write down the value of the deferred revenue to avoid double counting revenue. Another good question comes to us from Neil. He asks, a company with a higher price to earnings ratio that acquires one with a lower, is this accretive or dilutive? I like starting with the definition first so that we're all on the same page. The price to earnings ratio, or PE ratio, is the ratio for valuing a company that measures its current share price relative to its pre-share earnings, otherwise known as EPS. The price to earnings ratio is sometimes known as the price multiplier or the earnings multiple. And another answer to your question, Neil, is you really can't tell if it's accretive or dilutive unless you also know that it's an all-stock deal. If it's an all-cash deal or an all-debt deal, the PE multiples of the buyer and the seller don't matter because no stock is being issued. Sure, generally getting more earnings for less is good and is more likely to be accretive, but there is no hard and fast rule unless it's an all-stock sale. I hope that made sense. You too can play this back, listen to the recording, and write that down. And if you need any further information on that, Neil, just send me an email and I'll get in touch with you, or we could even talk on the phone and I can explain that a little further. Well, this has been a very busy and productive year for us. We've got a few things going on at Gross Rose and More that I thought I'd share with you. In the very near future, we will be adding a few new staff members, and I look forward to introducing them to you. Right now, I'd like to tell you about three new senior executive advisors with our firm. Their names are George Cohen, Donald Brett Crawford, and Guillermo Ariza. These advisors will allow for an increased client coverage, as well as the inclusion of more industries within our knowledge and experience base. I'm telling you, these three are a great addition to our firm, and you can check out their bios and contact information on our website. I'm going to tell you a little bit about all three of them now, but there's more details on our site. I'll start with George Cohen. Mr. Cohen is an energy industry professional with 40 years of international and U.S. domestic experience. He has spent 22 years serving on boards as well as being responsible for the operations, P&L, development, assessment, and construction of conventional and renewable power projects in East Asia. During that time, he served for 6.5 years as partner Equus, which had over 6 gigawatts of renewable power under development, construction, and operation throughout Asia. He also represented Equus as a board member of Oriental Gas Limited, which operated 13 natural gas distribution assets across China. George has substantial electric power, oil and gas experience. He has earned a BS in mechanical engineering from Texas A&M and an MBA from the university. He served 18 years in the Navy Reserve and is a registered professional engineer in Texas. It's really good to have George on the team with us. Next, I want to tell you a little bit about Donald Brett Crawford. Brett was born in Houston, Texas. He's been a Houstonian for most of his life. In 1983, graduated from Texas Christian University and became the youngest General Motors dealer in the country at the age of 22. After honing his business acumen, he sold the dealership and joined the family business, Crawford Enterprises, Inc. It was founded by his father, Don Crawford, in 1971 and was in the business of packaging, leasing, and selling gas compressors and generator power systems in the industrial, oil, and gas industries. After Brett further expanded his business ideology, he was promoted to VP of Sales. In this position, he grew the company to become the world's second largest producer of compression and generator packages. When he sold the business in 1988, they led the industry in highly specific compressor and generator offshore packages. Brett has continued to expand his business practices by diversifying into many other businesses where he's been able to replicate his success at Crawford. Even though Brett has been intimately involved in all operations of other types of businesses, he has remained steadfast in his focus on manufacturing and supplying products into markets and industries with unsurpassed quality. And Brett, too, he's a great team member. We're so lucky to have him on board and look forward to a long career and profitable relationship with him. And last, but certainly not least, Guillermo Ariza. He was born and raised in Caracas, Venezuela. He earned his bachelor's degree from the university there and a master's degree in business administration from Boston University. His work experience has been in the corporate finance and business development fields, both in the U.S. and in Latin America, assisting a broad variety of emerging growth companies to address successfully their most important business and organizational issues. He has consistently led clients to see and take action on the need to rethink business models in view of what market innovation and shifting competition dynamics. He is involved in several fundraising initiatives for nonprofit organizations in the South Florida area. He's an avid golfer, lives in Boca Raton with his wife, his son and daughter, and his yellow lab. Another great addition to our firm, and thank you, Guillermo, for having the confidence in us that we have in you. We're really looking forward to seeing what we all do together as a team and look forward to the prolific contribution of these three. I've kind of alluded to this before, but we're also preparing some major upgrades to our website, marketing materials, and the development of a newsletter for our clients and subscribers. We hope to have all of this completed prior to year's end. We're starting to run out of time today, so I'd love to take a moment and thank our listeners for checking out what we've had to say today and participating in today's program. So please join us next Friday again at noon Eastern, where we will continue to explore the events and processes within our industry and then provide you with valuable interpretation of what that means to you and your business. Keep sending in your questions to be answered on the air, and as I've told you before, if I don't get to them during the broadcast, I will personally email you with the answers to any questions you may have. Once again, thanks for listening to M&A Today. Have a great weekend. We'll talk again next week, and I'll talk to you on Friday. Bye now.